This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
The idea of dumping Gazans in either Somaliland or Somalia is really hugely unpopular and untenable because, for one, the Somali people of both Somaliland and proper Somalia are very, very pro-Palestinian, and neither state is prepared to suddenly handle a huge refugee population.
Somalia's recognition of SSC Katumo as its sixth federal member state has radically shifted the Horn of Africa's geopolitical dynamics, with implications for Israel, Palestine, and Ansar Allah, aka the Houthis.
So let's say that this effect on the working class will be lower wages and lower employment in some of the vulnerable sectors. How much, we don't know, because this is still such a dynamic situation.
Johannesburg political economist Patrick Bond talks about how Trump's tariffs will affect South Africa and the working class.
This appears to be Angleton's intent to frame Oswald with Kostakov to blame the assassination on the Soviet Union.
Filmmaker Oliver Stone and author James DiEugenio discuss revelations, both new and old, that shed more light on the conspiracy to assassinate President John F. Kennedy. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. The geopolitical dynamics of the Horn of Africa are always volatile, but more so now than ever. The world's attention is most drawn to the region by Ansar Allah's disruption of crucial maritime routes in the Red Sea in support of Palestine, and Donald Trump's proposal to remove and dump the entire population of Gaza in war-torn Sudan, Somalia, and/or Somaliland, the unrecognized Somali secessionist state. Both the U.S. and Israel have considered recognizing secessionist Somaliland as a state in order to turn it into a U.S.-Israeli military enclave on the Gulf of Aden, near the mouth of the Red Sea, and just across from Houthi-controlled Yemen. However, on April 14, when the Somali federal government recognized SSC Katumo as Somalia's sixth federal member state, the formal boundaries of the secessionist state radically shrank. What will Israel and or the U.S. recognize now? A shrunken state with contested borders? There is also nationalist resistance in northwestern Somaliland, where the people of Oudal region also want to be part of the Somali nation. I spoke to Dr. Abdirahman M. Abdihashi, senior advisor to Abdikadir Ahmed Awali, the leader of the new regional state of SSC Katumo, about the implications of Somalia's recognition. Dr. Hashi, tell us about the uprising in SSC Katumo that led to its recognition as Somalia's sixth federal member state on April 14th.
The people of SSC Katumo rose up at the end of December 22, revolting against the oppression and subjugation of Somaliland, the regime in Somaliland, that began in October 2007. So it's in nearly almost 15 years. The Dulbahante clan, who are the majority of the people who live in SSC Katumo, are proud and patriotic people who strongly believe in the unity and sovereignty of Somalia. They do not want to be part of secessionist Somaliland, which is essentially a project of the Isaaq clan that's based in the capital Hargeisa. The Somaliland administration waged a full war against the people of SSC Katumo on February 6, 2023. And for six consecutive months, Somaliland forces indiscriminately shelled the city of Las Anod, destroying schools, mosques, hospitals, residential buildings, and they have displaced over 220,000 people. During that period, the people of SSC Katumo did not get a support from the government of Somalia. They were on their own with the support of the Somali diaspora. On August 25th, 2023, the Somaliland forces were defeated by the people of SCC Khartoumo, and the blue Somali flag was raised in the city of Las Anod. The federal recognition came after the people of SCC Khartoumo administered themselves for 2 years in a manner that was very impressive to the regime in Mogadishu. The people of SCC Khartoumo have a history of fiercely resisting the British colonialism under the leadership of Mohammed Abdullah Hassan from 1899 to 1921, almost a period of 21 years. These fierce fighters were known as the Dervishes and renowned for their bravery. Drawing on that historical spirit of freedom fighting, the people of SCC Khartoumo are now part of the federal government of Somalia and no longer dominated by the regime in Hargeisa.
What about Awdal in northwestern Somaliland?
Well, the people of Awdal also want to be part of Somalia and the Somali nation, and they don't want to be part of the secessionist Somaliland. They are resisting even though they are under the occupation of Somaliland.
Hargeisa, that's the capital of Somaliland, is now claiming that SCC Khartoumo has seceded from Somaliland. But Somaliland is not an officially recognized state that anyone could secede from. It's not recognized by any of the 193 UN member states. While Somalia holds a UN seat and currently a seat on the Security Council, only Taiwan, which is recognized by only 12 tiny states, recognizes Somaliland. Is there any legal forum where Somaliland might take its claim to SCC Khartoumo?
None whatsoever.
Okay, Somaliland has long been a project of the right wing of the British government, which has been joined by the United Arab Emirates and the right wing of the U.S. In the U.S., the Ultra-Right Heritage Foundation has long advocated recognizing Somaliland so as to turn it into a U.S. military enclave on the Gulf of Aden, near the mouth of the Red Sea and just across from Yemen. Some of them claim to speak for Trump, saying he plans to recognize Somaliland soon, but Trump himself has not said anything to that effect. Israel has also considered recognizing Somaliland in hopes of both establishing a military base and even dumping the people of Gaza there. That's a proposal that Trump also recklessly put forth. So what is left for the U.S. and Israel to negotiate with now that SCC Khartoumo has become the sixth state of Somalia?
Well, first of all, the idea of dumping Gazans in either Somaliland or Somalia is really hugely unpopular and untenable because, for one, the Somali people of both Somaliland and proper Somalia are very, very pro-Palestinian, and neither state is prepared to suddenly handle a huge refugee population. Further, Somaliland would do anything for recognition, most of all by the U.S., and it has been reported that Somaliland's foreign minister, Abdurrahman Dahir Adam, suggested he would agree to take the Gazan refugees, but he denied it, no doubt knowing how unpopular that would be in Somaliland and Somalia and the rest of the world. Second, regarding the issue of the U.S. military base in Berbera Port, Hassan Sheikh Mahmoud is the president of Somalia for the entire country, whose UN-recognized borders include Somaliland. So he has offered the U.S. exclusive control of air bases, ports, including air bases in Valedogle and Berbera, as well as the ports of Berbera and Bosaso. So the U.S. doesn't need to recognize really Somaliland to expand its military presence there.
Okay, it seems like a sad situation with Hargeisa, the capital of Somaliland, and Mogadishu, the capital of Somalia proper, arguing about which has the authority to hand air bases and ports over to the U.S.
It is a sad situation, but you have to consider how greatly Somalia has been weakened and fragmented by decades of U.S. intervention. In 2006, the U.S.-backed intervention by Ethiopia, then led by the brutal Tigray People's Liberation Front, TPLF, overthrew the Islamic courts, which had managed to establish a welcome order after decades of conflict following the 1991 collapse of the Siad Barre government. they committed hair-raising atrocities, and the terrorist group Al-Shabaab then emerged as a result. As you know, Somalia has been struggling against Al-Shabaab ever since, and the peacekeeping force created to fight them, called AMSOM, which was rebranded recently as ATMIS or AUSOM, has essentially been a self-preserving force that does not really fight against Al-Shabaab terrorist insurgents. It has the African Union brand, but it has been funded by the US and the European Union. The Trump administration, however, abstained in the most recent reauthorization of a UN resolution to renew support, citing the mission's failure and lack of financial transparency, and therefore leaving AUSOM, the latest iteration of the African Union forces, in limbo. The last thing I would say is the multilateral forces have been well paid by African standards, so they have really no reason to see the conflict come to an end and every reason to continue it. These so-called peacekeeping forces have been arrested on many occasions for selling arms in the open market. In short, U.S. intervention has had very long-term, really destabilizing consequences in Somalia. According to a 2023 report by Brown University's Costs of War Project, the U.S. has spent more than $2.5 billion to defeat Al-Shabaab, only to have the opposite effect, leaving Somalia more fragmented and weaker than ever. So, ill-advised or not, Hassan Sheikh Mahmoud, the president of Somalia, offered to hand Somali air bases and ports over to the U.S. can be understood as an attempt or a desperate attempt to keep the Somali nation together.
Well, unity would seem to be a prerequisite of sovereignty.
That's fair to say.
Okay, the U.S. and Israeli military are all but indistinguishable. But what about Israel's aim of establishing a base in the Gulf of Aden? Wouldn't that be unpopular, given how pro-Palestinian the Somali people are?
Indeed, it would be very unpopular. That proposal would put Hassan Sheikh Mahmoud in a very delicate and difficult position.
Okay, is there anything else you'd like to say?
Yes. Well, I would say Somalia is of interest to all the world's great powers because of its geostrategic location and its vast resources. Its northern coast sits at the mouth of the Red Sea. It's estimated that 15% of the world's trade passes through the Red Sea, including 12% of its seaborne traded oil and 8% of its liquefied natural gas shipments. It's also close to the Strait of Hormuz, the world's most important oil transport choke point. Another point I want to make is Somalia has the longest coast in Africa, with huge fisheries and huge offshore oil and gas reserves. The interior in Somalia also holds large oil and gas reserves, as well as gold, diamonds, uranium, and many, many other minerals. These strategic military and resource interests really complicate the politics of Somalia, causing some global and regional players to support Somaliland secession and others to support the federal government and its territorial integrity and sovereignty. The United Arab Emirates, or the UAE, has military strategic interests, but also strong economic interests, which are best served by fragmenting the country and weakening the federal government. The UAE has been pushing hard for the recognition of Somaliland, spending tens of millions of dollars on lobbying and public relations campaigns, including campaigns in the social media platforms. I would also say the UAE wants to control several of Somalia's ports, Bosaso in Puntland, Berbera in Somaliland, and recently Kismayo in Jubaland, which is at the southern border of Somalia close to Kenya. DP World, which is a UAE state-owned corporation, bypassed the federal government to sign long-term contracts with the regional governments of Somaliland and Puntland to manage their ports of Berbera and Bosaso, respectively, and therefore they want to protect the trade dominance that their port, which is called Jabal Ali in Dubai, they want that port to dominate the trade in Africa. The other point I want to make is, according to reports I read on the Middle East Monitor reports, open source intelligence, there has been an aerial imagery that confirmed that the ELM 20843-EASA, which is a multi-mission radar manufactured by Israeli defense firm called ELTA, a subsidiary of Israeli Aerospace Industries, has been installed near Bosaso Airport, adjacent to the UAE-run Bosaso Air Base. Another key player in Somalia is the government of Turkey, which also has geostrategic, economic, and political interests and competes with the UAE. Turkey is a very strong supporter of the federal government of Somalia and does not support the recognition of Somaliland. It has a long-term contract to manage both the port and the airport of Mogadishu. Qatar does not have economic interests in Somalia, but they support the federal government in part to really minimize the destructive influence of their nemesis, the UAE. They built infrastructure, mainly roads, and provide budget support for the federal government of Somalia. Turkey and the UAE are really, in essence, fighting a proxy war in Somalia. Turkey is arming and training soldiers of the federal government, while the UAE is arming and training soldiers in Somaliland and two other federal member states of Puntland and Jubaland in order to weaken the authority of the federal government. President Trump hasn't really recognized Somaliland despite the efforts of lobbyists in the US, the UK, and UAE, and the Somaliland they championed ceased to exist when the nationalist forces of SSC Khartoum defeated the secessionist forces in August 2023 and established an effective administration in the region. The federal government of Somalia's recognition of SSC Khartoum as its sixth federal member state formalized that reality.
Dr. Hashi, thank you for speaking to Pacifica Radio.
Thank you so much, and I greatly appreciate for giving me the opportunity to give our perspective. Thank you.
That was traditional Somali music. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. Trump's tariffs are hitting South Africa hard. At the same time, billionaires like Elon Musk and David Sachs, both of whom have deep South African roots, are helping to drive privatization and cryptocurrency schemes that threaten workers' rights. Pacifica's Steve Seltzer spoke with Johannesburg-based political economist Patrick Bond about the impact of these tariffs on South Africa's economy and what they mean for the working class.
Well, it's great to be back with you and your viewers, Steve. Thanks for having me.
So why don't you talk about the impact of the trade war that Trump has launched on South Africa and Africa, and what does it mean for the working class, and what has been the response to it?
Yes, it's obviously a trade war that has implications across the world. And South Africa has had, just by way of background, a little bit more of the pressure points because of the, let's call it the anti-racist tradition and the anti-genocide movements by the government against the State of Israel in the International Court of Justice, which you know, very much implicates the US for its funding and militarization and its legitimation of the Israeli regime and the decimation of Gaza right now, something that obviously when Donald Trump wants to just clear everyone out and take it over as U.S. property and build some sort of Riviera, well, South Africa stands with in solidarity with Palestinians, and that's probably the single biggest side of conflict, and the second being affirmative action, that is land reform and black economic empowerment, which means that some of the black bourgeoisie are given a piece of the action from every foreign investor. And several, most important, was born not far from here in Pretoria, Elon Musk. They don't want that. Musk is also at the same time negotiating for his SpaceX satellite internet service, Starlink, to be brought here, and he doesn't want to have a black partner. That's obvious enough. So when you put those together and you say, well, there are several things that the U.S. aid cuts that started in January, February, decimating about 18% of our AIDS medicines budget and prevention and treatment, which has not been made up by a very neoliberal government, which is now going through a big budget crisis. And then you put on top of that the climate, let's say, Just Energy Transition Partnership, JETP, $1 billion loan. It wasn't a great loan. It was at market rates. The main U.S. Subsidy there goes to help the New York bankers as a special loan guarantee. It was also $56 million in grants. Those would have probably been helpful to for South Africa's decarbonization. And on top of that, then there's, let's call it the AGOA threat. So the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act is indeed the site where the most concern about tariffs being raised, because this is a zero tariff program. And its main beneficiaries, Steve, have been the auto companies, Mercedes and BMW and VW and Toyota and to some extent Ford. And those companies have had zero tariffs from the imports US gets from South Africa, plus steel, aluminum, and as well, we've had quite a strong recent upsurge in citrus and vineyard products, grapes and wine. Now, as that gets cut, because what Trump has done is just gotten rid of all of those, we can expect two things. One is that the US consumer will consume less in general, because those prices represent a higher, you know, inflationary attack on their living standards. So the working classes of the U.S. who might have got some of those relatively cheaper cars or steel or aluminum or, you know, citrus or grapes, wine from South Africa, that's now going up. But secondly, that it's differentially going to hit South Africa, because what Trump has done is put 25% on all steel and aluminum. And automobiles, it's a little bit more complicated because of some concessions that the car companies have been able to win from especially Mexican and Canadian imports. But, you know, Steve, it's just one of these wacky times when it's such a zigzag of positions, and where I think the other factor for the working class is when the China trade war really gets underway, unless it's somehow halted, then there's a huge overaccumulation of capital. That is, excess production. It's not just sort of excess capacity that the US complains about in the green energy, let's say the electric vehicles and the batteries and solar panels that we know we need so much more of, and to use the terms excess capacity in describing solar is ridiculous. But it's all the other activities in the capitalist sector of China that is now probably going to result in vast exports that we're going to the U.S. now going everywhere else. And already South Africans have put, the government has put tariffs, punitive tariffs against imports of steel and tires and things like garden tools, all sorts of things that come from China are already considered dumping, even though, you know, South Africa and China are together in the BRICS and allies in so many ways. So let's say that this effect on the working class will be lower wages and low employment in some of the vulnerable sectors. How much, we don't know, because this is still such a dynamic situation.
And maybe you can talk about the effort of Trump to bring the Afrikaners to the United States and the whole racist ideology, fascist ideology of the Trump government and his supporters, Musk, Thiel, Peter Thiel, and David Sachs from South Africa. What role do they play? Because a lot of Americans are shocked that these South Africans have now been put in place to basically run the U.S. government, the Doge, and to run cryptocurrency. These people have been put in the top positions, the state apparatus in the United States. Who are they? And yes. How do they get in that position?
Yeah, and how do they become such monsters as white South African boys raised in the 80s? I wonder how. Yeah, they were being trained, Steve, to run the apartheid system or the corporate elites of South Africa in the most corrupt city, according even to PwC, of world capitalism, Johannesburg. I'd add another, the editor of Breitbart, Joel Pollack, who was born but moved very quickly. I mean, I think within weeks of his birth, his parents emigrated, but he was hoping he would be the U.S. ambassador to South Africa and was on the TV and commenting the last few weeks regularly with the kind of arrogance and I think intelligence as well. I mean, the guy's very smart. He wrote a biography of his mother-in-law, who was at one point a leftist. So it's very interesting characters that you get. I would say, yeah, the South African, let's say, boys that we produce, especially in this city, Johannesburg, Elon Musk being the most notorious because he went to high school here, Bryanston High School, and he was thrown down a couple of flights of stairs and beat up. And so he was so badly hurt, he calls himself beat nearly to death by his peers. And so he's 2 months in hospital and then over to a different high school in Pretoria. But, you know, his father, who he doesn't like, his father, Errol, says, well, actually, Elon, I couldn't defend Elon on that because Elon had been teasing another boy about his father's recent suicide. So that's why the sort of, you know, beating up exercise, the hazing, the bullying. And that's what little white boys, I think, are accustomed to here in this awful city is basically being, you know, Wild West. They might have started brilliant little fellows like Musk was, you know, autistic and probably knew some African languages from his nanny. But then they get, you know, as 1% kids often do, they get trained to be absolute bastards. And now the next thing about this problem of Afrikaners is I'm not sure quite who is feeding this myth that there's some sort of genocide or systematic murder of white farmers, but it has gone quite a long way. And it's you know, something that Trump himself raised in 2018 when he was already trying to kind of keep South Africa down. The crucial point in all of this, though, as Trump regularly puts out on his Truth Social, is that South Africa is hosting the G20. Johannesburg is the host city. We were supposed to have Marco Rubio come in February. Scott Bessent was meant to be in Cape Town with the finance ministers in February. So these ministerial meetings that are very important to kind of getting momentum and getting some solutions to global crises, as if we could expect the G20 to do that. U.S. is boycotting, and Trump very clearly said he intends to boycott. Now, something else has just happened this last week, which is Vladimir Zelensky visited, and Cyril Ramaphosa, who had been very clearly leaning to Vladimir Putin as a BRICS ally, and with, you know, the old historic Soviet support for the African National Congress as a big constituency, including Labour, advocating for stronger ties with Russia. But I mean, what Ramaphosa hopes to do, it's not entirely implausible, is play some sort of mediating role. You know, he did the same in my own hometown, Steve, that's Belfast, Northern Ireland, in the late 90s as the Good Friday Agreement was, you know, being monitored in the early 2000s as well, before it was implemented in 2005. Ramaphosa went to make sure the Irish Republican Army had kept all their arms caches sealed away. So he had sort of had some function, let's say, in legitimating these sorts of peacemaking exercises. And he did bring African heads of state last June to, June 23, so a year, nearly 2 years ago, to visit both Zelensky in Kiev and also Putin in Moscow. And nothing came of it. It was a bit of a waste of time, a bit of a PR exercise. But Ramaphosa has these ambitions to be seen now as the chair of the G20 hosted here in Johannesburg as someone who can actually do deals. And then that would give him the opportunity, he thinks, to have a game of golf. He keeps talking about, his press secretary keeps saying, we just want to bring Donald Trump out on the golf course. I don't think they know he's a notorious cheater. Actually, maybe they do. But the point being that they're in this position of flattery. The other thing that they did, the New York Times reported on in February, is to pledge offshore oil and gas potential fields that we don't really know because the exploration hasn't gone very far. Total and Shell and some local guys, and even Brazil's state-owned company, as of late last year, Petrobras, they're already doing this seismic blasting. And they think there are some oil and gas, especially methane gas fields. So, of course, there's lots of protests, more than 100 protests across the Indian Ocean in the south, and on the west coast, the Atlantic Ocean. And so it's going to be a very messy situation if that's indeed what the offsetting deal that is being offered to Trump and his oil company friends, ExxonMobil and Chevron and Anadarko and Peabody. And if that goes forward, then you'll see much more intense contestation of trade deals with South Africa. The working class angry about all sorts of things, but not yet focused enough, not yet doing serious protests. The last protest we had against one of these trade deals was when South Africa hosted the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act conference in November 2023. And it was just after the Israeli genocide had begun. And unfortunately, we couldn't pull all the trade unions out of that meeting. Both COSATU, the mainstream, tied with the ANC, and NUMSA, the metal workers, which, of course, most vulnerable because of the aluminum and steel and auto workers. Jobs being on the line if these cuts happen. And, you know, Steve, I'm always asking my friends in, you know, these institutions, there's a lot of electricity that goes into aluminum smelting and digging the iron and digging out deep gold and platinum and all the things that we do with our minerals energy complex. Lots of electricity that goes into the automobiles. So if we do have a lower effective demand from the West, from the US, and then next year from Europe, because of carbon border adjustment mechanisms, another kind of trade sanctions, climate sanctions, then maybe that electricity should go to labor intensive industry, maybe even small businesses and households. But the point being, we're always facing shortages. The last few days, what we call stage two of blackouts, of load shedding. And I think that is the sort of debate I'm hoping the working class begins to grapple with, which, what should we do with dirty electricity? How do we phase it out? How do we have a genuine green just transition? Meantime, if Trump is really going to kill some of that market from South African exports to the US, and we think regardless of what happens to the rest of the tariffs, he has a really nasty streak when it comes to South Africa and South Africans in these sectors, again, aluminum and steel and automobiles. Well, that electricity maybe would do much better for job creation and economic development than as it currently stands, big multinational corporates who produce, take the profits away and don't reinvest.
That was University of Johannesburg political economist Patrick Bond speaking to Pacifica Steve Seltzer.
Uta utla makuwa are, ari yengo Midlands. Uta utla makuwa are, ari yengo Midlands. Sizo hamba busuku nemini, siye kone Midlands. Sizo hamba busuku nemini, siye kone Midlands. Midlands, Midlands. Midlands, it's andosa. Midlands, 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 it's andosa. Midlands, 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 it's andosa. Midlands, 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 it's andosa. Uta utla makuwa bare, yeye, hari yengo Midlands. Uta utla makuwa are, uwo, ari yengo Midlands. Sizo hamba busuku nemi, siye kone Midlands. Sizo hamba busuku nemi, siye kone Midlands. Midlands, 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 it's andosa. Midlands, Midlands.
That was Miriam Makeba, Meadowlands. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. Filmmaker Oliver Stone and JFK researcher James E. Eugenio joined The Katie Halper Show to discuss new revelations from JFK assassination files recently released by the Trump administration. They also argue that despite the new documents, conclusive evidence of a conspiracy has been available for years.
Basically, my perception of the case was molded by Jim Garrison's book, which was given to me in 1989 or 7 or 8. And I read the book. It's fascinating. And it was written by Jim as a mystery almost. It was that well organized because he'd written a book 20 years before. And he was going over the same evidence, basically, in the 80s as he was in the 69 period when he wrote Heritage of Stone. Jim was a very impressive man. And in addition to Jim, I was introduced to Fletcher Prouty, who was in the Pentagon, and he worked with the CIA. He was a what they call the focal point officer, and he provided hardware for the CIA's, all their black ops all over the world. And that was a character that Donald Sutherland played in the movie. So the movie, as you know, went through a possible scenario. I called it a counter myth to the myth. And we did a lot of research, but obviously we didn't know everything that we've learned since then. What was interesting about the movie is it led to such an outcry that Congress moved reluctantly, I would say, to pass the JFK Records Act in order to once and for all clean up this case. That's what they said. I mean, they would put out all the documentation that they had unless there was a real important reason not to. They appointed an Assassination Records Review Board of five people who were fairly conservative scholars, and they didn't have a lot of money, and they existed, correct me if I'm wrong, Jim, they existed till 98. They worked from
94 to 98.
They didn't have a lot of money.
And then ran out of money, right?
They ran out of money, which was, and you know what? They actually were somewhat effective. They had some good people working with them, like Doug Horne and Jeremy, what was his name?
Jeremy Gunn.
Jeremy Gunn was a very smart fellow. They did some good work. We can fill you in on that. That's what we were dealing with. It came out and it was totally ignored. It was a blackout on it. Essentially, the reigning newspapers at the time said, there's not much there, or it's a nothing. We don't see anything different. And it's Oswald did it alone, which is not true. And they kept to that story because we couldn't provide anything dramatic, like would breakthrough information. We have to accrue the information. This occurred to me as we were doing it, is that this is a very complex case. It's a cold case. And many people are dead. But at the same time, if you look at all the clues as they assemble themselves, you can put it into a computer and you can figure it out. This is not what it was appears to be. And Oswald, we're saying, it does not even appear to have been on the sixth floor where the shots supposedly occurred. And where are the shots from? What we found out in our investigation was that you have to follow what they call the chain of custody. And the chain of custody on the bullets and on the rifle, that's very important. And on Oswald and on the autopsy, you've got to go through all that stuff again. Remember Mark Lane, who was the first one I heard who contested the case back in 63, 64. Mark Lane, they asked him, "What, Mr. Lane, do you have any new evidence?" And he said, "What's wrong with the old evidence?" And that's really the nub of the case. You have to look at the old evidence and the new evidence. And together, you're going to find a conclusion that is pretty clear that it could not have been Oswald, and it could not have been three shots, as the Warren Commission said. But they never backed away from that. The press, the media supported it, never backed away. And what Jim and I tried to do in 2019, it was?
We started in 2019.
And we brought out a documentary called JFK Revisited, which is a very important document. It's 2 hours. There's a two-hour version. There's a four-hour version. We tried to put the essence of what the Assassination Records Review Board was saying onto film so that people might understand better. It did very well. Documentary's still out there on Amazon, but you know, it's a documentary as opposed to a feature film, so it doesn't quite get the same attention. But the major media never paid attention. They never paid attention. And that is it's a crime really against the American public. They're not doing their job. People like you paid attention. But we can bring it down to you for 6 or 7 points. And I think that would give you an idea what we were talking about.
See, what Oliver said there is, this is one of the reasons we made the 2 hour and the 4 hour version, because the MSM completely ignored
the mainstream media.
They ignored all the discoveries of the Assassinations Record Review Board. And there were some very, very, very interesting discoveries that they made in those 4 years. You know, but Oliver did a really nice job on the medical side in that film. They discovered the House Select Committee on Assassinations printed a deception in their volumes. In volume 7, page 37, you'll see a quote that says, "Unlike the witnesses at Parkland, none of the witnesses at Bethesda saw this blown out back of the skull on JFK. All right. Well, when the review board declassified all the House Select Committee documents, that was false. All right. Just as many people saw this blown out back of the skull at Bethesda as saw it at Parkland. 42 witnesses, 42 eyewitnesses saw this. Now, I probably don't have to tell your audience that is strongly suggestive of a front wound, because it's exit wounds that leave these big blasted out holes, you know, in the back of a skull. All right. Another thing that Oliver brought out with Doug Horn, and I think this is very explosive. When Horn and Jeremy Gunn interviewed John Stringer, who was the official autopsy photographer, they brought out the pictures of Kennedy's head, okay, which Stringer was supposed to have taken. And so Stringer walks up to the easel. He puts his face like right up to the pictures. And he says, "This is Ansco. I didn't use Ansco. I used Kodak Etchachrome." And he says, "You see these numbers here at the bottom? This is a press pack. Okay, I didn't use a press pack. These numbers denote a series. I took separate dual folders." And so at the end of the interview, Jeremy Gunn asks him, "Are you ready to deny you took these photos?" And he says, if that's a press pack and if that's Ansco, I didn't take these pictures. And so then Oliver very adroitly had Whoopi Goldberg then say in the film, "Well, if he didn't take them, then who did take them?" You know, and we segue to the whole series on Knudsen. Okay, Robert Knudsen, whose family said he took. So the question becomes, why? You know, you would think something, not really. You know, between me, you, and Oliver, you would think something like that would make a blip in the press. You know, it didn't. It didn't at all.
It suggests, just to sum it up, that there's false pictures of Kennedy's body out there. That's what the public was shown. So that doesn't look like it was a massive head wound in the back of the head, which
was
out in the front. So they buried that. They not only buried it, they distorted that evidence. That's a very important point.
You see, this shows a high level cover up. Okay, you couldn't have a bunch of Cuban exiles or the mafia do something like that. You know, only somebody at an upper level in the government could do something like that. Okay, and then the third thing that we should bring up is Oliver also did a nice job on CE-399. And in the film, you'll see Gary Aguilar says that he saw this report that said Bardwell Odom, an FBI agent, showed the bullet to the first two witnesses at Parkland, Tomlinson and Wright. And Gary says, "Well, how come there's no FBI report, a 302 on that?" And there isn't. There's only a Justice Department cover sheet that says it. So he tracks down Bardwell Odom and he says, "Did you show CE-399, the magic bullet, to Tomlinson and Wright?" And Odom says, "I never showed that bullet to anybody. and if I would have shown it to Wright, I sure as heck would have remembered it, because I knew Wright very well when he worked in the Sheriff's Department." So in other words, here you have the FBI lying about the identification of the magic bullet. You know, so in addition to all the things that Oliver put in his movie, you know, about the wild ride that CE-399 took, there's no, as Henry Lee told us, and he says in the film, there's no chain of custody. Okay. And any attorney will tell you, you know, if you don't have a chain of custody, the defense will blow your doors in, you know, at the trial.
There's also the chain of custody on the rifle, too.
Right. Very few people know about that. I'm glad we got that into the film, is that the rifle that the Warren Commission says that Oswald ordered is not the rifle in evidence. Okay. It's the rifle in evidence is a little bit over 4 inches longer. It's over 2 pounds heavier. It has a sling that Brian Edwards, who used to work on a SWAT team in Kansas, said that Oswald could never have attached that sling. It had a screwed on thing that Oswald could not have done. So CE-399 would never pass muster in a courtroom. The rifle, you couldn't present that. And Henry Lee actually said this to us, and it's in the film. He says, these kind of things get the evidence thrown out in a court of law. It's called inadmissibility. of evidence tonight, the rifle was shipped to FBI headquarters in Washington. And as Brian says in the film, Sebastian Latona, the number one print expert at the FBI, is told to get prints off the rifle. He does everything. He dusts the rifle. He brings in the photographer. The photographer brings in lights to light it, to light the thing up. They're hours trying to get prints off this rifle. And at the end of the, I can't get any prints of value off of this rifle. All right. Now, Bob Tannenbaum told me, Jim, do you know how good Sebastian Latona was? Every DA in the country wanted Sebastian Latona at their trial because he had written the pamphlet that every department in the country followed. Okay. If he couldn't get prints off, then miraculously, a few days later, the Dallas police do get prints off it.
Good timing.
It's fascinating. The prints are very vague, right?
Yeah, he couldn't get prints of value off it.
In my movie, I suggested fictionally that someone went to the funeral home and imprinted, took Oswald's hand and put it on the rifle. It's the one explanation for how these vague prints got there. There was also, by the way, Oswald took a nitrate test on that same day and he didn't have any nitrate clues on his cheek. Nothing.
Yeah, that's true too. Yes.
I mean, all
no
these
nitrates on his cheek.
This is basic Sherlock Holmes shit. And they miss it. That's why it's so annoying to me that they say, what's the new thing you got? Well, what's wrong with the old shit?
Right.
That no one ever proved it. And no one ever did the basic detective work that was required. Because why? Because there was such a mess bureaucratically. It's clear that Lyndon Johnson didn't want to go into an investigation for real because he feared it. He feared what would come out. He feared that there'd be a war. That's what he said to the Warren Commission.
Right. Okay, there are some interesting things. I mean, nobody can read 77,000 pages, right, you know, in a brief period of time. But so, for instance, what we found out is, see, the Kennedy assassination really bothered Castro, okay? And on the night of the assassination, he made a speech, okay, saying, you watch, they're going to try and blame this thing on us. All right. And then 4 or 5 days later, he made another speech saying, look, I know about rifles. Why would this guy use a manual bolt action rifle if he was going to be doing this thing? All right. Well, guess what? In 1969, it bothered Castro so much, he ordered a reenactment of the Kennedy assassination. And he said, I want my three best sharpshooters to try and do what Oswald did. Okay. And guess what? None of them could do it. And in fact, this is one of the most telling things about this whole case is that nobody's ever been able to duplicate what Oswald did. The only way CBS did it is that they cheated. All right. They enlarged a target twice the size of what Kennedy's head would do. And then they covered it up. One other thing that is pretty interesting, I think, is that if you recall, on the day of the assassination, out of James Angleton's office, they said that Oswald had conferred with Valery Kostikov at the Russian embassy in Mexico City, and Kostikov was part of Department 13, which is supposed to be in charge of liquidations in the Western Hemisphere. The CIA in 1971 wrote a memo saying, we don't have any credible evidence that Kostikov was part of Department 13. All right. This appears to be Angleton's, his intent to frame Oswald with Kostikov to blame the assassination on the Soviet Union. If that second CIA memo is true, okay, that's very interesting. One last thing. Robert Blakey, who was the head of the House Select Committee, was writing letters to CIA about how do you set up a 201 file and what are the reasons for setting it up? And I want to see Oswald's 201 file. The reason he said this, Katie, is because a very funny thing happened to Oswald's file when it came in. when he left for the Soviet Union. He had a woman named Betsy Wolf working for him on this assignment. She examined all the charters of the CIA. And then when she was done, she did an imaginary graph. Okay, this is what Oswald's file is going to do. Now give me the file. So she gets the file. And guess what? It doesn't do anything like what it's supposed to do. Okay? Instead of going to the Soviet Russia division, it goes to the Office of Security division. Here's the catch there. The Office of Security does not set up 201 files. That's why Oswald did not have a 201 file for 13 months. When Richard Helms was confronted with this, he said, what? Because Oswald didn't have a 201 file? You know? And so finally, she interviews all these people. She brings in a guy named Bob Gambino, who's the head of the Office of Security at the time in 78. He says, look, it doesn't matter how many documents come in. It doesn't matter if they're pre-stamped. If the client has gone to the first gate, which is the Office of Mail Logistics, that is where all the documents will go to. What this means is somebody was rigging Oswald's file at CIA at the time he left for the Soviet Union. Can you imagine that? I mean, nobody even knew who Oswald was at this time. Yet somebody in the CIA is rigging his file. That's what Blakey was so worried about. And the punchline is this. Betsy Wolf's work never got into the HSDA volumes. We didn't know about it until it was declassified by the ARB.
The big thing about this latest information is that it's the degree of involvement of Oswald with the intelligence community. That's the massive evidence of some kind of collusion. How does this guy who apparently has no background and is a bum and is a lone nut, how does a lone nut happen to know all these people who he's seen with in New Orleans and in Dallas and in maybe Mexico City? He's seen with agents. Why does Angleton have his name on file from 59 on? It indicates what Richard Schweiker called the fingerprints of intelligence are all over Oswald. And we have never faced up to that because why? Because the CIA is sacred in American political history or something. They're not sacred. They're a bunch of criminals. This is what we're trying to say. And we've been saying it from the beginning. I got scorched by this, scorched for criticizing them as thugs. As basically mafia, and they we know that they cooperated with the mafia. People in very important leadership posts. They include Richard Helms, includes I think Alan Dulles, although he stays clean as much as he can of the whole thing, but he's in charge and he's fired by Kennedy and he's around the case for all these months. He stays in Washington. He goes to every meeting of the Warren Commission. He monitors the Warren Commission, makes sure that they know nothing about Cuba, the Cuba operation, which this he knows a lot about. He doesn't open his mouth. He doesn't say that we're trying to kill Castro all this time and we're financing these anti-Castro groups in Miami. We have a gigantic station called
JM Wave.
JM Wave with a how many people there? 800?
There's hundreds of agents at JM Wave, yeah. It's almost 1,000. Okay.
In other words, it's bad intent. It's bad faith.
That was Oliver Stone and James DiEugenio discussing with Katie Halper both new revelations on the JFK assassination and key evidence that has been systematically ignored by mainstream media. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective with contributions from Steve Seltzer, Thomas O'Rourke, Polina Vasiliev, and myself, Ann Garrison. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at Pacifica CRD. I've been your host, Ann Garrison. Thanks for listening.